Hi, everyone, and welcome to the SRHM podcast. My name is Nina Sun, and I'm an associate editor for the SRHM Journal. We're releasing this episode of the podcast just a few days before the International Conference on Family Planning, which takes place in Thailand. Given the global climate around sexual and reproductive health and rights, this topic is very pertinent. As such, we are pleased to share this insightful conversation, which is moderated by Sarah Gullo, who works as an independent consultant. Sarah is joined by Christine Galavati, a senior program officer at the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, and Fevin Mekuria, a senior advisor in community health systems at CARE. Together, they discuss reproductive power and aligning actions with values in global family planning. This conversation is inspired by a recent article on reproductive power and family planning written by Christine and Sarah, which was published in the SRHM Journal. The link to the article is available in the episode description, or you can find it at srhm.org. We hope you enjoy this episode.
I'm Sarah Gullo, and I am so excited to be here today with Christine Galavati from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation's Family Planning Team, and Fevin Mekuria from CARE's Health, Equity, and Rights Team to discuss reproductive power and aligning actions with values in global family planning. In thinking about our discussion today, I thought back to a gathering that took place in 2014 on the Oak Glacier in Iceland. In 2014, mourners gathered to commemorate the loss of the Oak Glacier. And actually, at this gathering, the group unveiled a plaque, and I'd like to read you what it says. Oak is the first Icelandic glacier to lose its status as a glacier. In the next 200 years, all our glaciers are expected to follow the same path. This monument is to acknowledge that we know what is happening and what needs to be done. Only you know if we did it. In unveiling this monument, they wanted to make it known that the melting of the glaciers and planetary health is humanity's choice. And if we truly value planetary health, we need to align our actions with this value. And you may be thinking, okay, but what does this have to do with reproductive health? But interestingly enough, Chris and I noticed a similar sentiment in a 2020 journal article regarding human health and well-being.
Yes, in 2020, Donald Berwick, a leading authority on healthcare quality improvement, said exactly that. We know what we need to do to improve human health and well-being, but we're choosing not to do what needs to be done. In fact, after decades of research, no doubt exists that factors outside the healthcare system, social, economic, and environmental conditions, are largely responsible for health and well-being. And life expectancy is a great example. If you take the subway from Midtown Manhattan to the South Bronx in New York, life expectancy drops by 10 years, 6 months for every minute on the subway, 2.3 years per mile traveled. And in fact, at the population level, no existing or conceivable medical intervention comes within an order of magnitude of the effect of place on health. But still, as Berwick pointed out, we have illogically and drastically underinvested in addressing the societal and structural factors. And by doing so, we're choosing not to improve things, which is why Berwick coined the term the moral determinants of health and has called for actions that are truly aligned with our values if we really want to improve health and well-being.
Moral determinants of health is a powerful term and really highlights humanity's agency and power in determining health and well-being. However, I think it's important to note that for years, reproductive justice activists and scholars like Loretta J. Ross and Jackson Dixon Diallo have been calling for this realignment, recognizing that health cannot be extracted from the economic, social, and political context in which it's produced or inhibited. So, Fevin, why do you think that global health actors are just waking up to this reality?
Yeah, I think that in part, the COVID-19 pandemic has made the profound inequality of the current world impossible to ignore. With disparities in full recovery from the disease and deaths affected by geographic, racial, social, and economic status, early in the pandemic, I remember some of the glaring disparities that were highlighted. For example, a New York Times article in 2020 pointed out that South Sudan, a nation of 11 million, had only 4 ventilators, while the US had more than 170,000. Documented disparities and potential collateral damage inflicted by the COVID-19 pandemic, such as delays in healthcare, increases in social isolation, decreases in vaccination rates, and associated far-reaching risks related with that, kind of invoked a renewed sense of urgency in attending to the health of groups that have been left behind for so long.
Yes, I agree, Fevin. And I think a turning point is at hand. And I really think this provides an opportunity for the global family planning community to ask what this all means for us. But I think some in the community may push back on this and say, we've been discussing values for the past 28 years. They may point to the 1994 landmark International Conference on Population and Development, commonly known as ICPD, which marked an important shift in the lens in which the global community thought about reproduction, away from a primary focus on population issues and fertility reduction, to one grounded in the rights of individuals to control their bodies and reproductive lives and attain gender equality. Or they may point to the voluntary rights-based family planning language and frameworks. So Chris, where do you think we're falling short?
Well, I agree. We have a long history to draw on. And as you say, remarkable gains have been made, but we really have still fallen short of ICPD's vision. Despite our stated commitments to the larger goals of gender equality and reproductive freedom, we often still frame the problem as one of inadequate supply or demand. And family planning programming is still usually narrowly focused on contraceptive information, products, and services. We rarely tackle the broader issues of poverty, limited economic and educational opportunities, gender inequality, racism, and harmful social norms, all of which inhibit people's ability to realize or even imagine a range of possible futures, and all of which block achievement of one's reproductive goals. So, you know, by maintaining this narrow focus, we really risk diagnosing and solving the wrong problems and probably missing the biggest, most transformative opportunities to unleash people's reproductive power. It's interesting. I've had a range of discussions with people working in family planning on this topic, and many acknowledge how important the broader social and structural context is in determining whether individuals can make and act on their reproductive choices. And yet they either see this as not our lane, or they feel constrained by the system, by their donors, their organizations, their governments. And I get this, of course, but if we're not willing to at least try to engage and challenge the social and structural determinants, what are we really doing?
Great question. And I recall from our previous discussions on this topic that you had an analogy that really brought the problem with the not our lane argument into focus.
Yes. Whenever I think about this dissonance, I always think of the cancer researcher Siddharth Mukherjee, because he called out the medical community for the very same thing, for focusing on what fit within their narrow mental model versus embracing a more expansive model that was really necessary for transformational change. He shared that if you think about human physiology as a vast global telephone network with interacting nodes, then all of the medical community's focus was in one tiny corner on the edge. It was like they were a pole operator in Wichita, Kansas, who was tinkering with 10 or 15 lines. And I love that analogy because sometimes I feel like this is happening in our global family planning community. We're just tinkering with 10 or 15 lines and actively ignoring the rest of the factors that influence the outcomes we claim to value. The moral determinants of sexual and reproductive health are real. And I think if we want people to own their reproductive lives and be able to exercise their reproductive power, then I believe our global family planning project has to be focused on transforming the conditions that undermine their ability to do so.
I totally agree, Chris. Fevin, have you seen evidence of this mismatch as well?
Yes, a recent assessment of a health program in Yemen, which was a part of the COVID-19 pandemic response that has a specific focus on the continuation of essential SRH services during the pandemic, actually comes to mind. So as part of the assessment, we were asking community health workers about their experiences in the program. And they told us that one of their biggest challenges was the fact that after conducting multiple home care visits for pregnant women and providing them with referrals to health facilities, most of the women were not able to go. And the women repeatedly said that the reason for not following the recommendation for facility checkups was not because they didn't understand the information or trust the advice that they got, but due to high costs associated with transportation to the facilities, as well as costs of healthcare at the facilities. So this is an example of the dissonance Chris has mentioned. We cannot isolate or compartmentalize people's challenges into boxes to fit to the single issues or narratives that we want to design our programs around. And to end on a positive note on the example that I just gave, the community health workers, most of whom are also women and members of the community that they serve, voiced this challenge and heard their recommendation. The program started distributing cash vouchers for critical reproductive health services for pregnant women in those program areas.
Great example, Fevin. Measurement is another place where I see this mismatch between our values and action. You know, we continue to largely measure the success of family planning programs by increases in modern contraceptive prevalence rate or reductions in contraceptive discontinuation. We say we care about reproductive rights, agency, and power, but do these measures capture that? They don't. At best, they fail to capture reproductive agency, and at worst, they contribute to impeding it. I'm not really saying we shouldn't measure these things, as they do tell us something about what is happening. So I wouldn't suggest we throw them out completely. But we should be careful to not position them as the sole indicators of program success. But it does matter what we measure, because as they say, what we don't measure doesn't count, right? So I am encouraged by, there's been a number of recent efforts to improve our measures, to do a better job measuring what really matters. One example, a few years back, CARE developed a tool called the We Measure, a multidimensional measure that tried to capture agency structure and relational factors contributing to sexual and reproductive health. And more recently, a number of researchers have been working on conceptualizing and measuring things like reproductive autonomy, contraceptive agency, and most recently, sexual and reproductive well-being in a very holistic way. So I think this is really exciting work and does have the potential to move the field forward.
So it sounds like from what you were both saying, the global family planning community has been talking the talk about values a bit, but not walking the walk. But is there something about this moment in our history that makes it special, more urgent? Why focus on this now, Chris?
Yes. Well, while turbulent, the moment we're in has made it really clear, as Fevin pointed out, that reimagining our approach to global family planning work is not only desirable, but necessary. The resurgence of repressive narratives and resulting programs and policies that cast family planning as a solution to climate change, resource scarcity, poverty, and migration. These are all red flags, and I think we need to take heed. These types of narratives undermine people's reproductive power and also ultimately fail to address the underlying causes that drive all of these injustices. Also, I think it's really important to note that as issues are catastrophized, as climate change increasingly is, solutions that abrogate rights are more likely to be seen as justifiable because people say, well, it's an emergency. You know, we have to act now. We don't have time to be thinking of these higher level issues. Therefore, I do think now more than ever, we need to have a clear value-based goals, language, tools. We need to form alliances that can help us together challenge repressive narratives and articulate clearly why a focus on the benefits of family planning to outcomes other than people's reproductive power is dangerous.
I hear what you're saying, but people may argue that emphasizing the economic or environmental benefits of family planning to governments is a win-win if it increases resources for voluntary family planning programs. How would you respond to this?
First off, no serious argument can be made for family planning as a climate change mitigation strategy. The extensive use of fossil fuels for energy production, food production, and transportation by wealthier countries are the primary drivers of the high rates of greenhouse gas emissions causing climate change, not population growth or consumption by the world's poor. So while this idea is unfortunately sticky and persistent, it's just not true. Second, and perhaps more importantly, this narrative focuses responsibility on the poor and vulnerable, whose individual choices will have the least impact on the problem. And it removes responsibility from those causing the problem. About 100 fossil fuel companies are responsible for over 70% of global emissions, and therefore planetary heating since 1988 at least. What we really should be talking about is the uneven distribution of land, fixed capital, and credit that concentrates wealth in the hands of a few while leaving the majority without the material means of preparing for or responding to climate change. But this is exactly what those contributing the most to climate change don't want us to focus on. And then also some people will say, well, what about family planning as a climate adaptation strategy? Isn't that important? Well, family planning as a climate adaptation strategy is at best a band-aid on a bullet wound, and at worst, a misdiagnosis that legitimizes the current unequal systems and allows the underlying cause of climate vulnerability, which is inequality, to persist and worsen. So actually, no, I don't think it's a win-win. I would say it's a lose-lose.
I couldn't agree more, Chris, with that. And I think it's important also to point out that instrumentalizing family planning always risks licensing coercive interventions. People sometimes say that one-child policies, sterilization camps, etc., are things of the past. But in fact, between 2018 and 2020, during a time when immigration was being catastrophized in the US, in Georgia, where I currently live, as many as 57 immigrant detainees held in Irwin County Detention Center were reportedly pressured to undergo unnecessary gynecological procedures, including taking depo-provera shots. And some were even forcibly sterilized. One woman actually said the doctor told her, "You're an old woman, why would you want to have more babies?" to try to pressure her to get a hysterectomy. And another woman was deported and dumped in Mexico, still bleeding after a gynecological procedure, with no idea what happened, and just the feeling that whatever happened was wrong.
Evan, thanks for that example. It made me think that it's really important that we do not forget that preventing people from having children in order to fix broader social, economic, or environmental problems has a long, ableist, classist, racist, and sexist history. Joya Creer Perry of the National Birth Equity Collaborative highlighted this point during a talk I heard her give recently, in fact. She gave the example of how Richard Nixon put family planning clinics in Black and brown communities as his anti-poverty strategy in 1970. But she explained that if he wanted to end poverty, he could have given free college or free childcare, things that he had the power to do, and that, you know, might have actually resulted in less poverty. But instead, he framed women's reproductive decisions as the cause of, and thus the remedy for, poverty. We hear echoes of this same logic today in the way we talk about the demographic dividend and climate adaptation strategies and how, you know, family planning can help us achieve those. I would also just encourage people to read Jade Sasser's book titled On Infertile Ground, which does a great job of unpacking the history and the damage of these kinds of narratives.
Thanks. You've both made great arguments for why a values-driven evolution is needed for global family planning at this very moment. So what now, Fevin? What do you recommend as next steps to advance this agenda?
There are a number of things I think we need to do. We need a shift from health programs and systems designed around diseases and institutions to programs designed for people. We need multi-sectoral policies and actions to address the upstream and wider determinants of health, including poverty, gender inequality, gender-based violence, nutrition and education. Programs need to engage and enable individuals, families, and communities for increased social participation and enhanced self-care and self-reliance in health. We also need radical listening and respecting communities' voices, articulated needs, priorities, and solutions that work for them. I mean, nothing for the people without the people, as the saying goes. And it is powerful what can happen when we listen and respond to articulated needs. When I was working in Ethiopia's Amhara region with CARE, we heard that adolescent girls who were married were extremely isolated and faced little control over their reproductive lives and futures. Working with the girls themselves and their communities, we designed and delivered a reproductive health and financial savings and loan curricula to over 5,000 married adolescent girls via reflective dialogues and actions in peer-based solidarity groups. 4 years after the project ended, we were stunned to learn that 88% of the solidarity groups continued meeting without continued assistance from CARE. And the girls started to actually replicate the approach on their own to reach more girls. And we did research on this and found that girls valued the impact this program had on their lives, not only on the SRH outcomes, but also on their connections, mobility, economic opportunities, household relations, etc., which inspired them to continue and scale the work on their own. Radical listening and responsiveness had radical impact.
Wow, that's inspiring. I think we can also look to the reproductive justice movement in the U.S. to inspire this value-based evolution that we've been calling for in our article. Founded by Black women activists in the 1990s and grounded in human rights principles, the reproductive justice framework is defined as the human right to maintain personal bodily autonomy, have children, not have children, and parent the children we have in safe and sustainable communities. So as you can see, it prioritizes individuals' experiences and preferences related to reproduction, while placing individuals within the context of their families, communities, and societies, and explicitly acknowledging the role those forces can have in facilitating or impeding reproductive autonomy. And it sounds like the program that you talked about in Amhara did exactly that, really thought about these young women in a very holistic way.
I agree, Chris. And I also think the family planning ecosystem you and Sarah put together can be another input. I like how in the framework, reproductive power, the ability to make and act on one's reproductive decisions, is put forward as a value-based goal of global family planning work, and that the framework embraces the idea of a dynamic interconnectedness ecosystem of individual, relational, and structural elements that interact to facilitate or impair a person's reproductive power.
Yes, thanks. But ultimately, I think the global sexual and reproductive health and rights community and the family planning community, whatever you choose to call it, really needs to come together with leaders spanning reproductive, climate, gender, economic, and racial justice if we're going to chart a way forward. All of these things are interrelated, interdependent, and call for greater solidarity and collective action. Now, I know it won't be easy. We speak different languages, we have different histories, but what's the alternative, really? Future generations learning about glaciers in history books?
Well said, Chris. Thanks, Bevan and Chris, for highlighting the path forward. To wrap up, I was reflecting on the fact that the Global Family Planning Community will be gathering in Pattaya, Thailand this November 14th through 17th for the International Conference on Family Planning. Inspired by the powerful Oak Glacier Monument, I was wondering what plaque you would unveil in Pattaya if you could. Chris, let's start with you.
What a great question, Sarah. I think the Oak Glacier Mourners really said it perfectly. So I think my plaque for the Global Family Planning Community would say the same. This monument is to acknowledge that we know what is happening and what needs to be done. Only you know if we did it.
That sums it up perfectly. What I might add to the plaque is we say we care about sexual and reproductive health and well-being. When will we mean it?
When will we mean it? Powerful. Thank you, Bevan and Chris. This has been a truly informative and invigorating conversation. You have given us a lot to think about.
Thank you to Sarah, Christine, and Faven for this insightful conversation. Please see the episode description for links to the resources mentioned by the speakers. This includes a link to Sarah and Christine's article entitled Reproductive Power and Aligning Actions with Values in Global Family Planning, published in the SRHM Journal. Thank you for supporting the SRHM podcast, which was produced by the SRHM Communications team. The music was composed by Thibert Christian and Salomon Botond.